Welcome to East Meets West, episode...
What is it? 58.
58. I'm Molly Wood.
Wow, you're so handsome today.
Wait, no. That's the wrong show. That's not how this show begins.
No, we have our cavalcade of stars and then, you know, a bear on a tricycle juggling red balls.
We should have a, we should have like a Don Pardo-like opening.
Like...
Starring Roger Chang as Roger Chang.
Yes, which wouldn't... I don't know. I don't know. You could do the Ed McMahon, you know.
Here's Django.
We could.
Yeah, we could, but we're not. So we were starting to talk on the car ride over here about this book you're reading, Roger.
Yes, Uncouth and Nation, which is very interesting. It's basically the... It's a exploring the roots and not the the roots and causes of European dislike of America, and it's interesting because I was telling you because it's not although he does touch on a lot of stuff presently, you know, because I think it came out this or late last year, but it goes back to the history of the founding of the United States and the kind of antipathy or and how do you pronounce
antipathy
and you got it of
what he
of,
said
yeah of Europeans toward America.
Yeah.
Or United States.
Well, you were saying that it goes back to colonial times when people sort of looked down their noses at the American experiment as an extension of looking down their noses at the English.
Yeah, and it was considered the same thing because the English were portrayed as the crass, you know...
backwater, crass, uncultured.
Yeah, but, I mean, they driven by money and, you know, concerns for profit... You know, even hypocritically so, they were seen as still a very classist, feudal society, even though a lot of Europe was also that way. But, you know, when you refer to the other, it's always good to point out their faults and not your own.
Sure, sure. And
it's interesting because for a lot of colonies around, like, either a Commonwealth, you know, formerly like Australia or New Zealand or perhaps a French colony, you often get that sense that those colonies have always been, you know, kind of looked down upon. In fact, in Australia, it's, you know, that's why they call, you know, Brits or English, the English in particular, Pommies, you know, Palms.
Right, prisoners of His Majesty.
Or pomegranates, you know, there's a big thing, discussion about where that whole word came from. But, yeah, every time Australia faces off against England in cricket and rugby or something, you know.
Well, New Zealand calls them Palms, too, I think.
Well, yeah, but that extends from the same thing because, you know, they were often looked down as cruder, less, you know, perhaps mentally or physically, unfit individuals.
It is unusual in the United States. The stereotypical characterization of the English is usually as effete, feminine, sort of.
I think, you know, and I think that has to do with a lot is because it wasn't so much against, you know, the majority of Brits. It was against the ruling, the elite class.
Do you mean the revolution?
Yes, I mean that's where you got it. You had the effete, you know, British, you know, either governor or perhaps a salesperson,
some wig wearing,
yes, you know,
a salesperson,
not salesperson, but trader. I'm sorry,
right,
you know, because they went door to door and shit selling.
The marketing department of England ran the colonies.
But no, you're right. No, traitors or perhaps, you know, people in positions of power. For example, you know, when the Redcoats were buried in, you know, people's homes, it was like, well, you know, here's another example of blah, blah, blah.
Well, I feel like the part of the reason that there was a negative attitude toward the colonial rebellion was the same reasons that adultery is punished so harshly. The Americans
Expound,
were experimenting
please.
With something that wasn't allowed, but could bring great pleasure, you know. And
I always thought the same of bigamy myself.
It may be something that a lot of Europeans wished they could do, and in fact, you know, the French Revolution eventually.
But you know, happened. It's interestingly, ironically enough, I mean, the French Revolution came about because of Francis King's support for the American Revolution, which, you know, the French imitated.
Well, the French supported the American Revolution to get back at the English.
Exactly.
They didn't care a dime about
this. The French ruling class did it to get back at the English.
Yeah, yeah.
But when the French, you know, the peasants, can I say the peasants? Or
I guess.
I don't know. What do you call them?
Politically correct in the Middle Ages.
What do you refer to them as?
The French Third Estate.
Okay. The French population that wasn't wealthy. How's that? All right, so, you know, they saw
people.
That with...
The people.
The folks.
The Volk.
Oh, yeah, they could get into the whole German thing, too. But, it's, yeah, like, so they turn around, yet they put in Napoleon, who, you know, down the line acts very much like the royalty that they replaced and beheaded and, you know, the whole woohoo off their heads and let them eat cake.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think one of the things that you see in the cultures of other former British colonies that you don't see in the United States is... a tendency to take pride
in poking
in
your
the,
finger
in the culture that they have. You know, in New Zealand and Australia, there's a little bit of a sense of, and even in Canada, there's a little bit of a sense of we do it better here. We're proud of our English heritage.
Actually,
in the United States,
Actually, I see that in Canada because they use that as a differentiator between them and
the United States.
Australia, it's very much. You know, they take pride in the fact that they managed to put together a well-functioning, you know, normal country that you know, ostensibly was put there as a penal colony.
Yeah, like, they
look
overcame.
Look what we made out of, you know, the stuff that the British didn't want to, you know, deal with.
And I think, but even so, there's a pride in that English heritage, if not in England.
Yes.
But in sort of like,
I would think in the tradition, not so much. Yeah,
yes, that's what I'm trying to say. The tradition in the United States, there's not. There really isn't
you know
any
why?
Pride in the tradition because we're all German.
Well, that's the thing. I don't think I'm German unless there's something my mom did tell me.
I'm not German either. But the majority, I remember very clearly in elementary school when I after studying history, you know,
went to the mirror and
thinking,
oh my God,
well, the United
I'm
States
German.
Is England, you know, is yeah. And I was of English descent, and I remember when I looked around one day and I realized everyone around me was of German descent. I mean, not every single person,
the last name,
but the
yeah.
majority.
Well, you know,
and I was like, wait a minute. And then I just started looking at the whole country and realized, wow, there's a large preponderance of non-English. It really is what I should say.
Yeah.
It was a lot of German in the area where I
was. But it's kind of interesting. I mean, you could look at it at the kind of the migration routes. And, you know, a good deal of the first wave of immigrants were either German, because at the time there was no federal German Republic. It was made up of, you know, parts of either Prussia.
All these principalities. And,
exactly. Yeah. And then you also had essentially, you know, the cast-offs from the British, you know, from the United Kingdom, like, you know, the Irish or the Scots who had to leave because they were trying to...
And Italians also.
Well, see, that's funny because all those didn't come until much later where you had like the 20th century great wave of migration in the beginning of the 20th century. You had a lot of the people that, you know, it's kind of weird to think about it this way, but they were not considered white enough.
Yeah, not at all.
And it's so weird because anyone who was Greek, Italian, Spanish, you know, essentially the whole Mediterranean region were not considered white.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for a good majority of the time, they were kind of frowned upon. But, you know, you had that influx of those people from that region, you know, not only just from Southern Europe, but you also had from like the areas like Armenia. And
I think, and this may be a big overgeneralization, but if you just want to talk in the broadest of strokes, the German immigrants of the time, the Germanic immigrants of the time, had a similar experience in the broadest sense to Asian immigrants. And I'm not talking about Asian immigrants in the 1800s, but more Asian immigrants of the 20th century.
It's interesting.
Where they were different. They were excluded. Germans were excluded and thought different and called the Dutch and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But also, they kind of kept to themselves and formed their own communities.
The author touches of that book I'm reading, The Uncouth Nation, touches on. In many ways, the Germans that left still had an affinity for the German culture. And because they were moving to a region that was considered Anglified, you know, basic English, they tried to essentially cushion sequester themselves away from the majority of the population. That's where you got, you know, the Amish, a lot of those communities, because they felt that their they're, you know, and you bring that thing up with recent, especially Asian immigrants, where they felt more comfortable, but they also felt that their culture was superior in many respects to kind of the vulgarity, the crudeness that they believe that the American culture at large was.
And then the Irish and the Italian are more akin to what you have with Hispanic communities today, where they're sort of kicked to the side and spat upon and looked down upon, but sort of kept trying and forcing themselves to integrate into the community. And eventually the Irish and the Italians really did, you know, just kind of, and it's funny to note, at least in San Francisco, a lot of the old Irish and Italian neighborhoods are now Hispanic neighborhoods.
Yes. Oh, a lot of the blue collar, like the whole area in the Mission. That all used to be blue collar, and then when the...
I can't remember the order. I think it was Italian and then Irish?
It
might have been Irish and then Italian, and then Hispanic.
Essentially, when you hit the gold rush, you had a large influx of people. It's interesting side note is that, like, in Argentina, a lot of the Italians that didn't make it in or couldn't get into the U.S., either when they got shipped back. So a lot of alternative, you know, countries to settle down, and one of them was in South America and Argentina, which is why Argentina has such... I didn't realize this until I was talking to my Spanish teacher, who was Argentinian in high school, or when I was in high school. It's not like he changed nationality after high school.
Suddenly became Argentinian.
But yeah, he's like 80 to 83% of the population is of Italian descent, which is why they like eating pasta and like, you know, certain and things. Like, I never understood why. It's like, oh, and then it kind of dawned on me. But it's like interesting you brought up Hispanics. Hispanics, I mean, according to the current sociologists, have the fastest adoption rate. That means they integrate the quickest of any group distinct or cultural ethnic group in recent history.
Although with Hispanics, you do have an unusual situation that you never had with the Italians and the Irish, in that many of the subcultures, if you're not talking about Nicaraguans or El Salvador, many of them were already here.
Yeah.
And they were actually the native population.
You already had an acculturation, I mean, because with the whole kind of Texas War.
The Mexican War,
which eventually turned into the Mexican War, and then the U.S. managed to gain, you know, Colorado, not Canada, California, and you know, various all those states. It's kind of interesting because those are all part of Spanish, or they're part of Spain's territory. Of course, they were undermanned and underfunded toward the end of their rule in that part of the world. So, they, you know, when Mexico ceded it to independence, they automatically gained all, but they didn't have the manpower either to explore or properly colonized, quote unquote.
It's a myth that a lot of people don't understand, that the Native Americans were all tribes on horseback being driven across the country and ended up on reservations. It's not true. There were large numbers of large populations of people in the Southwest who just stayed in their villages. And the settlements grew up around them or near them, and they would move in. You know, they'd move from the villages near Phoenix into Phoenix, or near Houston into Houston, or, you know, near Los Angeles.
What many people consider like the Great Reservation No Push during the middle of the 19th century or 19th early 20th century was actually, in fact, many of the tribes in the Midwest and not also like in around the Great Lakes region.
Right. Those were the ones that were driven into Oklahoma in a lot of cases, or driven farther west, and eventually rounded up and put on reservations, as I understand it. But there were large numbers of populations in the Southwest that just came under United States rule after the Mexican-American War.
Yep.
And stayed in the, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of like the same thing with the Spanish-American War. It's like, okay, Cuba's now a U.S. possession, the Philippines or U.S. Puerto Rico, and it's. I mean, like, for a lot of these people, it's like, whatever. It's like, it's just a new landlord there to, you know, I gotta you know, scrap together some money to pay off the guy.
But, I you know, the upshot of that book that you're reading is that every culture thinks, in some ways, thinks they're the superior culture.
It's funny because he actually goes, I don't know, because he doesn't really give any test cases for this, but a lot of it's kind of his opinion in the prologue, that that European anti-Americanism is separate from almost entirely different from the other type of anti-Americans you find in the Middle East, Africa, you know, South America, and Asia, because those countries have been directly affected most recently by either U.S. policy or direct U.S. action. So you can imagine, like, okay, if someone dropped a bomb on my house, yeah, I'm going to be pretty pissed, you know, about that that country and those people.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the European anti-Americans, like I said, has been there throughout the creation of the United States. It's almost like endemic. It's just ingrained.
Well, and the interesting thing is the U.S. is just now getting old enough to have a real identity. I mean, it's always had an identity that made up, you know, it the founding fathers and all of those that, you know, it's tried to use that as an identity, but it's just now getting to where it's been around for 300 years or so from colonial, if you count back to the 1500s, you know, 1600s. And there are people whose families have been here for 300 years or more, which is, you know, that's, do you think about it, that's where the Normans were as the rulers of England in 1300. In the 1300s,
like the guy from Seinfeld, Norman?
No, I'm talking about Normans, not Norm. The Normans around the 1300s, when they'd been there about 300 years, started to let go of a little of the French aspects of, and started to speak English and started to finally, you know,
I think
acculturate themselves to the land that they conquered.
I think it's also different in the way that, in many respects, I think Europe is still not politically or structurally, but, you know, mentally, subconsciously, they're still kind of very feudal society. They still have a political class. We have a political class, but it can go up or down, whether or not, you know, you can not only ingratiate, but you do something like a talk radio show, like one large, very large man who does a very heated rhetoric, you know, Republican radio show. You know, that's when you become part of the political. But in Europe, especially in France, you have to go to a school. You have to be kind of indoctrinated
mm-hmm.
with, you know, this is what it means to be, you know, a politician. This is not what it means to be. There's always that kind of, you know, strata where you have, you know, you have the intelligentsia, you have the politicians, and then you just kind of go down, you know, the proverbial ladder.
I don't feel it so much at all in California anymore, but
I definitely
in the East Coast noticed that sort of class feeling of I'm an old family American. But the thing is,
you remember when people used to say, you know, my family came over with the
Mayflower, exactly, which is again just tying it to England.
Yes.
It's not
which is, you know, kind of a, you know, interesting thing because it's one of those love hate relationships. I want to be separate from you, but I still want to identify with you. You
mm-hmm.
know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
In many ways, it's kind of like, you know, kids, you know, they when they get older, when they go, high school, they start to assert their independence. It's like, no, I don't want to, you know, I want to be independent. I want to do this. I want my own car. I want my job at the beauty salon so I can, you know, you know, go out with, you know, such and such. But at the same time, you still want to get that kind of sense of affirmation, you know, from your family that, hey, you're still part of the family. We're still going to invite you on, you know, family vacations and stuff like that.
I think they desperately miss the mark in talking about what is cool about America. What is great about being American is so often just Thule patriotic crap.
I think it
drives some people into anti-American, even if they are Americans, into anti-American self-hatred. When the fact is, America is a cool country, but not for all the reasons people are trying to tell you it's cool.
It's kind of weird. I mean, I think a lot of what people say, I don't know. It depends on who you ask, all right? You know, if you ask a war vet about, you know, what it means to be American, it means certain things to him as opposed to, say, a migrant worker or a new immigrant or, you know, a farmer or a businessman. I mean, those are all, I think, valid concepts. I think they're all equally, you know, equally right in their respect. I have nothing against people who are super patriotic. It's like, hey, you know, as long as you're not beating me upside the head with
yeah, I think patriotism is just often misplaced, and not always. But
see,
often.
I often see, and this gets my proverbial goat, is when people kind of you know, assume that patriotism and nationalism are one and the same.
That's a good distinction.
I do not believe. I know a lot of people are very patriotic. I knew a couple of kids whose fathers were Japanese. You know, they were interned Japanese, but they served in the U.S. military during World War II when they were sent to Italy. You know, they were still very patriotic. They were very upset. No, their fathers were very upset at the way they were treated, but they felt that they had a duty to the country. They were very patriotic.
Mm-hmm.
That they would list their lives to help, you know, a country that would treat them that way. As opposed to just kind of blind nationalism, the kind you see in the Balkans, even in Russia, where it's kind of
in some areas of the U.S. Yeah, where people just paste a thick patriotism means pasting a flag and yelling at anyone who criticizes the government.
Yeah, you know that.
That's nationalism to me.
That
my country, right or wrong.
I think that's. I think that's more of a. That's kind of your kind of standard reactionary.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get that anywhere you go. As soon as you know, it's kind of funny because one of my coworkers at work showed me a video from Top Gear, which is a British car enthusiast magazine show. Instead of traditional like car magazine shows where they do the standard, you know, car review stuff, but they also do things like they drive across, you know, different areas and, you know, do road trips. They did one in Alabama, and they rented these really crappy cars when they got into Florida, drove them to Alabama, and then they did this thing. Okay, who's the first one who can survive driving through Alabama with like their cars painted over with all these very kind of not jingoistic, but very kind of like, you know, America sucks and all that stuff painted on the car. So each one of them painted their competitors' cars with an equally nasty, like, I hate NASCAR, sucks, and, you know, stuff like that. Get to a gas station, this one woman comes out, what do you mean NASCAR sucks? And it says, and she said, hold on, I'm going to get my boys out here. And she goes back into the convenience gas station store, and they come out and they start getting their cars because they really feel like their lives are threatened. They get in the car, they start driving, they get chased by these people.
Yeah, but that's bullshit. I mean, really, that stuff's just propaganda. That's as much propaganda as anything else.
But that's what I'm saying is the way that person reacted is how anyone would react. If you drove a car, you drove a Mini, and you said, like, you know, the Brits are all a bunch of inbred, blah, blah, blah. You don't think you would get a very kind of violent
Limey bastards. Yeah, that's not fair. What I was trying to get at is that what's cool about the United States is jazz. What's cool about the United States is Flugtag, you know? What's cool about the United States is people going down doing Baja racing.
It's people
having the freedom to go do weird, crazy stuff, to invent things, to go nuts.
I totally agree with you, but I think what's cool about America is the warts and all, how it managed to go from slavery.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think it's actually captured in Stripes, in the movie Stripes, when Bill Murray gives that soliloquy about how we've been kicked out of every self-respecting country in the world. I mean, that's sort of the cool attitude.
Well, that's the thing is that I think more than any other nation, yeah, this country has made many mistakes, as has every other country, but I think this country has managed to move forward each time. You know, whether or not you agree with the Iraq war, we will move forward from that place. People often talked about like how this country is falling back and regressing. You know what? It depends on how you want to look at it.
Well, that's true of the world too, right?
But that's what I'm saying. How do you want to look at it? Do you want to look at it is, oh, we have this one bad leader, right? But we have a system in place that allows for that, and that will self-correct itself.
Hopefully.
Well, you know, that's the thing. It's like,
I mean, you never know. That's the thing.
That's true.
When you look back on bad leaders in the 1800s, say,
yeah,
you know,
but look, and
you find out, yeah, they weren't as bad as people thought they were then, and the system took care of the mistakes that they made. And the same thing is going to happen now. People are going to realize that Reagan, Bush, Clinton, the new Bush, none of them are as bad as people said they were.
But you know what? That's what I'm saying is that, you know, the way our system of, or ideally our system of government is organic enough that you can make those changes as need be. I mean, we're not, you know, like the French, how many republics have they gone through since the end of World War II? They had like four constitutions rewritten each time. I mean, you know, you think about it. We've been running on the same one since the, and I can't say we because I was. Because I'm an American, goddamn it.
I wasn't going to say anything.
I could see some people. It's kind of weird because when people always ask, even when I'm not in the, not even when I'm outside of the country, people say, oh, your nationality. I say, oh, I'm American. Uh-huh. And people don't accept that as an answer.
Well, and that's what I mean. That's what I'm saying when it goes back to what I was saying about America is just now getting to the point where it has its own identity because. And it's not quite at the point because you don't identify as American. You identify as Irish American or African American or Chinese American or, you know, Filipino American.
It's never enough to say American. There isn't no ethnicity. But that's the thing is I think one of the beauties is like of this country more than say any other, including for example a lot of countries. For let's I don't want to pick on Canada all that, but it's the closest approximation we have to a foreign country. Oh, I happen to get my ass
a closest
out.
Approximation to a foreign country? What?
Yes. I know that's bad, but, you know, I'm sure the Canadians ready to stick one in me.
Roger just made a faux pas, which is French. They speak French in Canada.
Yes.
Because, well, no, you know, they have multiple cultures.
A faux
cultures.
Pas assumes that I made a mistake. But,
oh, man.
Oh, I could hear those barbecues heating up.
You know, we're not going to be able to go through these comments. But
more than anything is that, you know, when the whole kind of, you know, give me, when the whole kind of melting pot, you know, metaphor was created by a Jew from the ghettos of Warsaw.
Mm-hmm.
And his whole take on it was that I come to America and I no longer have to be hindered by, you know, the social baggage that, you know, I've come with, whether or not, you know, I'm labeled as a Jew or whether or not I'm hindered by my own cultural, you know, beliefs or expectations. I can create a new person. And that was his whole belief that his name was Israel. Crap, I keep forgetting his last name or his first name. But his whole thing was a way to create a new people separate from the racial, you know, ethnic identities that people, you know, were placed either, you know, by themselves or by someone else, that they didn't have to fit or conform to those kind of beliefs. They could move beyond it and they could create something new. And that was the whole concept of, or his whole belief on the whole melting pot.
I want to thank Timothy for tipping me off to John Frumday, the cargo cult in Tana Island, Vanuatu. I talked about it on Buzz
Out
Loud.
I saw that. Someone actually sent that to me.
It's pretty cool.
It's interesting because, you know, cargo cults or something.
Carnal cults? Is that what you said?
That too. No, I said cargo. Don't make fun of me.
I didn't make fun. I was just clarifying.
No, I think you're mocking me.
Are you mocking me?
Well, it's kind of funny because cargo cults are something you always think about when you, cargo cult, isn't that like in a pulp novel or some sort of 1940-ish, like, you know.
Dick Savage.
Nick Savage, you know, or not, is that Dick Savage? No, Doc Savage.
Doc Savage.
Doc
thanks.
Savage,
sorry.
Man of Bronze.
Yeah.
It's so funny, but it's kind of weird. An actual cult that's still around today.
Still around, and they dress up in army uniforms and carry an American flag and
woo-hoo!
March around downtown.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's weird. Thanks to JS for the album art this time. Appreciate that. And we're not going to get into a lot of these, but JS did make a Flickr group for East Meets West. If any folks are interested, flickr.com/group/EMW.
EMW. Taste the root beer.
Also, a lot of talk about petrol versus gasoline. This is all, if you don't know, it's sabrilliant.com/EMW, where people comment on the various episodes.
And please, more people comment.
Timothy found that petrol is originally French, circa 1892, and gas became common as a word for it in America, circa 1905.
Although technically when you distill petroleum, you have different, you have kerosene, gasoline, mm-hmm. diesel.
Well, and Timothy also said in Korea, often they just call it oil.
Well, technically,
when they're talking about
gas
or anything, they just lump it all.
No, that's the same thing in Chinese. The same word for cooking oil is the same one you use when you pump gas.
And then Jonathan C. said in Latin American countries, it's combustible.
Combustible?
For combustible, yeah, because it's combustible material.
Combustible Edison. I love that band.
Combustible Edison.
Whee!
All right, so that'll wrap it up for us. Boy, we talk a lot today.
Yes, and I think we've managed to move ahead.
Look at that. I think we've made the world...
I think we've basically convinced
maybe
each other of our own
better.
Viewpoints. Woohoo!
All right, suburban.com/EMW. That's it.
And I want to encourage all new listeners to comment on our board. We need to know how many people are out there.
If you've listened this far, you obviously have something to say. So go say it.
Yes.
Bye.
Thank you.